This is Ringler Radio, where you get all the latest news and information about settlement solutions, litigation, mediation, and structured financial security from Ringler, the largest and most experienced company of settlement consultants in the United States. Ringler has been helping injured people and their families since 1975. Ringler Radio is made possible in part by American General, Liberty Mutual, MetLife, Mutual of Omaha, New York Life, Pacific Life, and Prudential. Now join Ringler Radio host Larry Cohen.
Well, hello and welcome to Ringler Radio, everyone. I'm Larry Cohen, the head of Ringler's Northeast Operations, and we're certainly glad you could join us today. Well, a wrongful death lawsuit was recently filed against the Boeing Company, Bell Helicopter, Textron, and Eaton Aerospace on behalf of the family of a U.S. Marine killed in a helicopter training mission in Hawaii. Matthew Detterman of Tucson, Arizona, was one of two Marines who died when the MV-22 Osprey helicopter crashed and burned during a landing attempt. The accident occurred on May 17, 2015, when the Marines were launching the Marine helicopter from the Navy assault ship USS Essex for practice landings. The Marine investigation concluded that the crash was mostly due to pilot error in the landing procedure, which is not an easy task. The Bell Boeing Company maintains the MV-22 Osprey is safe, and it's now currently deployed elsewhere. So today on Ringler Radio, we're going to have the opportunity to take a long, hard look at this Osprey crash and discuss some of the details of this tragic wrongful death case. And joining me today as my co-host is my friend and Ringler colleague Keith Christie from the Birmingham and Mobile, Alabama offices. Keith has over 30 years of insurance and structured settlement experience, and he's co-hosted with me several times before. So welcome back, Keith. Great to have you on Ringler Radio.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just great. I'm doing just great. And joining us today to discuss the Osprey case is attorney Michael Andrews from the Beasley Allen Law Firm in Montgomery, Alabama. Mike has handled several cases against manufacturers of aircraft, light and heavy trucks, automobiles, agricultural and construction equipment, and he's been here before. Mike, this is the second time you've been on Ringler Radio, so I want to thank you for being here again.
Hey, good morning, guys, and thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Terrific. Well, Mike, it is great to have you back. Can you give us an overview of the Osprey crash on May 17, 2015? It's believed that there were 22 Marines on board the helicopter during the training exercise. Tell us about the incident itself.
Yeah, what they were doing, the Marines like to practice for insertion, and they are, by definition, an expeditionary force, which means they're typically out front. So what they're doing in this crash is that they have a number of aircraft, and I think they had three in this particular chop or group that were leaving shipboard, taking off from ship, fully loaded, and coming in to land at the island of Oahu, at Bellows Air Force Base, and there are sections of the base that are sort of parsed out for different branches of the military to use. But they're coming in from the sea, and they're landing on a beach environment. And actually, this was not totally beach. They have a part of an old runway that is there for them to land on. So what they're going to do is attempt landings fully loaded for insertion, and each one of these aircraft carried 20 to 22 Marines and their pack, their personal equipment. So they're coming in from sea. They've begun to hover in a low formation to touch down. The nature of the V-22 is such that it can't land like an airplane. The engine nacelles have to rotate up because the prop rotors, the propellers are so massive that if it landed in airplane configuration, it would, tear the rotors off the airplane and tear up the runway. So what it does is it transitions into more of a helicopter mode, and it's going to come down in a hover. Well, the prop wash is significant underneath these aircraft, and so it begins to kick up dust and dirt and debris in the environment. This is something that that they knew, you know, the manufacturers, Bell, Boeing, Textron, all of the subcomponent folks knew that this was the environment that the V-22 is intended for, whether it's in Afghanistan or, you know, on the beach somewhere, or if it's in high in the mountains or down in Iraq or Fallujah. This is the environment that it's intended to operate in. So the first one or two of the aircraft that come in, settle in for landing, and they experience what they refer to as a reduced visibility landing, or sometimes they call it a brownout, which just means that enough dust has been kicked up in the air that they can't properly see. Yeah. So they wave off. They go around in a circle, and they come back and attempt another landing. And one of the aircraft, the one that our guy was in, comes down for the landing, experiences a power loss, even though the pilot is increasing the power. He's trying to climb and get out of the situation, and then he experiences a compressor failure. The compressor is just part of the engine, where the internal turbine blades are. He experiences a compressor failure, and the aircraft falls belly down, breaks open, catches on fire, kills one Marine at the scene. Our young man dies a short time later in the hospital, and then there were 18 to 20 injuries that really ranged from fairly severe to just some pretty good bumps.
Wow. Okay.
And so that's sort of a broad brush overview of what happens. They're coming in for an insertion landing, and they experienced a dust and crashed.
Exactly.
Mike, thanks for the explanation as to what happened to the Marine. The helicopter in question here, is it mostly a fixed wing helicopter type prototype type? Is it new? Is it been out there for a long time? And I understand that it is the Marines' main reconnaissance aircraft, but I mean, are there other aircrafts that involved, and you know, have they shown any issues?
Let me sort of take that one at a time. I don't know that I would classify it as their primary assault aircraft, because they do still have a number of much more efficient, much safer aircraft in their inventory. The V-22 Osprey, you know, is an aircraft that unfortunately has been around for a while and has been characterized by a series of catastrophic crashes. It's as much a political animal as it is actually a warfighting machine. When they were first developed, so the Marines were told this bill of goods that the aircraft would be specifically for them. This would be their baby, more or less, rather than having to take some piece of equipment from another branch of the military and adapt it. They were told this is going to be yours. And so the Marine mindset has always been, well, if we take a beachhead, you know, we're going to keep that beachhead until we decide to relinquish it. And that's sort of how they've reacted to the V-22, even though it is a very flawed aircraft. One of my very good friends was at the time the chief test pilot for the program. And one of his comments that he made, and you had to remember, too, that this is not our first case involving the V-22 or any of its variants. This is probably number three for me. And so years ago, he told me, look, this is an aircraft that is trying to be both a helicopter and an airplane. It's trying to do both. And as such, it's never going to be great at doing either one. It is a compromise by design. It is trying to take parts of an airplane and parts of a helicopter and incorporate those. And, you know, we've probably all seen the Harrier, which is a jump jet. The Harrier uses what's called ducted thrust. The engine stays still, but the thrust goes out a duct and is forced down to the ground. And by doing that, the pilot can move the aircraft around. Well, in the V-22, you've got propellers, and the entire engines rotate out on the ends of the wings. And so, you know, in terms of complexity, extraordinarily complex, and the limitations are severe. What we've seen over the years is that even though it was sold as it can operate in virtually any environment, each crash, and there have been a number of crashes, have acted to limit the operational environment that the V-22 is safe in. And so today, it really is only safe if you take off from a paved area and landed in a paved area. You can't really take off and land anywhere where you're going to have any sort of dust and debris and dirt, like the natural real world.
Yeah, especially in the Middle East, where you have sand and dust and craziness.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, wars aren't fought in parking lots.
Right.
And so this it's not a safe aircraft for use in any sort of an extreme environment, which is where war is fought.
No question about that. You know, we're talking about the aircraft and some of the deficiencies, and it's almost not fish or fowl. They were trying to combine, it sounds like, some features to make something somewhat unique. But at the end of the day, we're really talking about a young man who died, and you're representing the family of Lance Corporal Matthew Detterman, who was a 22-year-old Marine, and my understanding is he was going to be deployed and on his way to Yemen, to the Gulf of Aden over there, with a stop in Hawaii, where he passed away simply for the training exercises. Tell us a little bit more about Matt and his family. It sounds like a terrific young man.
Yeah, Matt was one of those sort of stereotypical Marines that grew up wanting to go into the military, and this is sort of the goal that he always had for himself. His family was military. Both his mother and father, both former military personnel. And Matt grew up in that environment. He lived in Tucson, Arizona at times. And he was exposed to the military mindset, to the military environment. He would see the aircraft. And he knew that that's what he wanted to do. The family was fully prepared for eventualities that could happen in battle, you know, things that can happen in Yemen and in very unsafe parts of the world. But this is one of those things that you never see coming when it's an equipment failure that lets you down during a routine training operation in Hawaii, of all places.
Yeah, but was he an only child, Mike?
No, he was not. And it's been, you know, been very hard on not only the parents, but his siblings.
Well, it's sad that we have that situation in a And I appreciate his service to this country. But in reference to the wrongful death case, Mike, can you give us some details on, you know, the case against Boeing Company, Bell Helicopter, Textron, and Eaton? Because if I'm not mistaken, this is a joint venture between Bell and Boeing. And I believe Textron is the mother of, is the parent company for Bell. So how does that all, can you tell us how that all works as far as the conglomerate of defendants?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It is a joint exercise that the companies, and there's a number of companies that fall under this umbrella. BAE, British Aerospace Systems, you know, the list is enormous. But Bell Helicopter, Boeing, Bell Textron came together and formed a joint enterprise to produce this piece of equipment. There are a number of subcomponent part manufacturers. Eaton Aerospace, in our case, at this point, we believe to be the primary entity responsible for designing and developing the air filtration system, which is, of course, the military loves their acronyms, and this is an EAPS, Engine Air Particle Separator. And it's a combination of a barrier filter, which is, I guess, the closest thing to that would be the filter on your air conditioner at home that you can change out. And there's also sort of a vortice-type blower system, which relies on air pressure and movement to sort of spin out the larger particles. And so the wrongful death case is really aimed at the entities that designed and developed the aircraft and those that designed and developed the filtration system. Because unlike civilian crashes, the military has a layered approach to crash investigation. You have command level investigations, and you have accident mishap boards, and you have oversight at a number of those steps along the way. And so we have the benefit now of having a couple of these mishap board investigation reports. What they found is that when this aircraft was hovering, the engine air particle separator and the filtration system failed to filter out all of the particulates, the dirt, the dust. and it is sucked into the turbine compressor, which is the part where it actually compresses the air and blows it out the back. Because of the high heat that is generated in the engine, those particles, the sand, they're accumulated on the hot surfaces and basically turn to glass. That's sort of a crude way of describing how glass is made to begin with. Heat, you heat silica and sand and calcium, magnesium, and all these different components, and you make glass. Well, when it lands on these super hot surfaces in the engine, the same thing happens, only it sticks, and it begins to restrict the flow of air in the compressor. The computer for the engine sees that restricted airflow and responds to it by trying to increase the rotational speed of the turbine. And it gets into this, sort of a fatal cycle there, where it's producing less and less thrust, but the computer is calling for more and more thrust. And so it just eventually overspeeds and causes a compressor failure. So that's what we have here. The manufacturers have touted, again, the benefits of this aircraft for years, but in this environment, it is simply not effective at all. Very unsafe.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, Mike. And it's lawyers like yourself who really pursue these kinds of cases that lead to corrections in some of the the equipment and technique that's used out there. So we're kind of depending, all of us, on you guys holding everyone's feet to the fire, especially the folks in power. Well, we're going to take a quick break right now and be back in a minute right here on Ringler Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Ringler Radio, celebrating more than a decade of podcasting and over 2 million listeners. Think of Ringler, the objective settlement advisors with more than 140 consultants in 60 cities nationwide. Visit RinglerAssociates.com today. There's a Ringler consultant in all the major cities of the U.S. No one has more experienced experts in the settlement business than Ringler. Check out our website at www.ringlerassociates.com for the best information for injured parties, attorneys, and claims professionals to find the Ringler advisor nearest you. When it's your interest at stake in a lawsuit settlement, you want only the best, most objective financial plan. You can count on Ringler Advisors to create a customized plan that meets the financial needs of you and your family for the future. Visit RinglerAssociates.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Ringler Radio. Glad you could join us. My co-host today is Keith Christie, and our special guest is attorney Mike Andrews from the Beasley Allen Law Firm in Montgomery, Alabama. Well, Mike, interestingly, the Marine investigation pointed to pilot error during a very difficult landing exercise, yet eyewitnesses reported that the engine cut off shortly before crash landing in the field. How do you go about reconciling these two views of the incident?
Well, let me say this about that. I think in the history of aviation, every single crash that's ever occurred
is
attributed to pilot error. Yeah, and even if the wings fall off the airplane, well, we blame the pilot for not being able to stay in the air. And it's even more significant in military crashes, because the military is so bent on this concept of muscle memory and training, so that if you're in an environment where something goes wrong, you don't even have to think about it. You just sort of respond and you do what you've been trained to do. And so the last thing the military wants to accept is, well, maybe this was a problem with the equipment. If it's a problem with our training, well, then we can just go push our guys harder and try to make them, not fail like this in the future, so we can prevent these things. The truth is, no amount of training can overcome a truly defective piece of equipment. And that's what you have here. This is something that, regardless of how highly trained, and by the way, the prior cases that I've had, in each of those instances, just like this, the guys are incredibly highly trained. These aren't new guys that have been flying something else and then just, hey, I think I can fly this. Now, the military will not put someone at the controls of one of these pieces of equipment unless they are very, very highly trained and skilled. You mentioned the eyewitnesses. You know, I spent a little time in Oahu on this case a few weeks ago meeting with those very eyewitnesses. And so I had an opportunity to sit down and talk with them face-to-face and to review video that they shot basically on their cell phones, because the area which the landing was intended to occur in, you know, had a golf course adjacent to it, had a lot of hiking in the area. And so there were a number of civilian and military witnesses around the area. Looking at the video, I can tell you that the plane tries to gain some lift. You definitely have an engine failure and then a crash. Of course, they call it a hard landing. But I will say that it was, I would agree with that. It was very hard, hard enough to kill some guys and injure a bunch of guys and destroy an aircraft. But you definitely have an engine failure, and the command level and mishap board investigation reports all say that that's what happened, that the turbine compressor blades are glassed over with this combination of basically sand that turns to glass under high heat. So, you know, again, I think every crash at some level they're going to try to attribute pilot error. But again, if the equipment fails you, you can't correct that.
Well, that's interesting, Michael. I mean, in your opinion, and do you feel like there was, was this preventable? And also, when it comes to the strategy of your case, you know, against these big transportation giants, how do you handle them? You know, how do you set this up?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. With the size of the defendant, and we just wrapped up hundreds of these GM ignition cases. And General Motors is, you know, a pretty large corporation. And so our firm and our cases have dealt with some of the largest companies in the world. So we don't really look at it as is this an unbeatable giant? Is this an issue that we can't overcome simply because the defendant is so large? We look at it in terms of how can we address this most efficiently? And what are some of the areas, because they're so large, that may help us? For example, in a case like this, with a company that is as advanced as Bell and Boeing, you have the benefit of electronic discovery. A lot of these documents that were produced in a computer and are in electronic format. And so that helps you, rather than going back to some of the old days of paper and reams of documents to go through. It does present hurdles, obviously. One of the very first things that Bell and Boeing and Eaton did in this case was to file a procedural motion to try to prevent us from being eligible to recover punitive damages and from being able to claim negligence. And not based on any of the facts, but purely a procedural issue, the court, of course, I briefed that issue and presented it to the court. The court already denied the defendant's motions. And so on a procedural basis, we are able to seek punitive damages and claims of negligence. In terms of how it could have been prevented, there are anecdotal stories in the field of soldiers that were using pantyhose to put over the barrier filter in an attempt to try to filter out more of the particles. I know, for example, that there are a number of theories in keeping particles out of an engine. There's a number of approaches there, and certainly there were variations of what was used here. In fact, my understanding is that not only is there another iteration in development now, literally as we speak, for the Marine version, the MV-22, but the Air Force version had a different filtration system. And they have used and tried and tested a number of these, and so we know that the one that they were using was not the best, was not the most efficient, for a number of reasons. So, yeah, the short answer is it definitely could and should have been prevented by a better design.
You know, Mike, it seems like, and from what you're saying, and of course what we read, is that the Osprey has had a history, really, of these safety issues that you're talking about over a period of time. And I want to close with this question for you. You know, during the presidential campaign that we're all going through right now, one of the issues that's being discussed is the rebuilding of the military and making the military more efficient. And one of the allegations out there is that the military-industrial complex and the lobbyists representing some of those big corporations in that complex are actually producing weapons and equipment that maybe the troops don't want, or maybe aren't the most effective or efficient for the fight that we have ahead of us. Has your case given you any insight into that issue as to whether or not, for example, you're talking about the Osprey maybe not being the most efficient in a desert scene? Are we producing equipment for a war that maybe isn't being fought?
Well, we're producing equipment that is not effective for real-world applications, regardless of where that fight is going to be. I don't think you can necessarily try to gear your military toward one particular environment. I think you have to be prepared for all potential environments. And unfortunately, the Osprey fails in most of those. This, again, originated as a political machine, was opposed by Dick Cheney, of all people, years ago, opposed to this aircraft. But because of the military-industrial complex that you referred to, there are so many jobs that are vested in producing this equipment. And so those jobs are continued to be protected at the cost of producing a piece of equipment that is less than what we need.
Well, Mike, I think that's the cautionary tale we all take from this, your case and this tragic case and the discussion we're having today, that, we're all going to have to be more vigilant as citizens and certainly as the political class to make sure that what we're producing for our troops that are trying to protect us is really the best equipment and not maybe the equipment that is being pushed by a certain element of industry. Is that basically what you're saying too?
It is, and unfortunately, there's only so much that the ground level military force can do, or even you or I can do. The only way to hold these companies responsible is through litigation, because they've shown they're not going to be accountable to themselves. They're not going to step up and take responsibility. So the only way to hold these companies accountable, to not only seek accountability for what has happened, but to prevent this from happening in the future, is through litigation.
Well, Mike, that's very well said, and thank you again, as I said previously, to you and all those attorneys that are keeping people's feet to the fire to make sure that hopefully doesn't happen again to anyone. Well, with that, Mike, is there anything else you want to tell us before we close out? Or I've had a terrific discussion here with you today, and give us your last thoughts.
Well, I think that as always, companies, regardless of their size, are going to try to do things the most economic way. Unfortunately, that sometimes translates to an unsafe way. And so we have to be able to rely on litigation to make the unsafe way more expensive, so that the natural approach then is that companies try to do things the most effective and the safest way.
Terrific. Well, very well said. Well, Mike, if someone wanted to get a hold of you and talk to you about any of these issues, how would they do that?
Best way to reach me typically is through email. It's Mike. Andrews@BeasleyAllen.com, or you can also just go to our website at BeasleyAllen.com and click on our different attorney profiles and can reach us that way.
Yeah, that is a great website. I've gone there myself. And Keith, how about yourself? If someone wanted to talk to you, find out more about structured settlements, how would they do that?
You can reach me via the website through RinglerAssociates.com, or you can also reach me by my email address at kchristie, that's C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E, at ringlerassociates.com.
Terrific, terrific. And I want to remind everyone out there that ringlerassociates.com is the website to find all the Ringler Associates around the country. We're in almost every city that you can imagine, and we're there to help you with structured settlement needs as they arise. And also, you can always find Ringler Radio shows on ringlerassociates.com, ringlerradio.com, legaltalknetwork.com, or on iTunes, where you can download and listen at your leisure. So with that, I want to thank my guest, Mike Andrews, for a terrific discussion. Thank you again, Mike.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Michael.
And Keith, thanks for being a great co-host.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much. Y'all have a wonderful day.
Thanks. And yeah, and the rest of you out there, you do go out and have a great day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. Thanks for listening to Ringler Radio, celebrating more than a decade of podcasting and over 2 million listeners. Think of Ringler, the objective settlement advisors with more than 140 consultants in 60 cities nationwide. Visit RinglerAssociates.com today.